letter with Dutch Foreign Minister Sigrid Kaag that this time Turkey will not handle the burden of refugees alone and will need a new deal with the EU, unlike the previous one, where the bloc would only pay a certain amount of money and leave Turkey to handle the rest.
On the issue of the Afghan migrants, there will be no such cooperation if the EU's approach would be based on we give money and you keep them there. We have fulfilled our responsibility. The number of migrants trying to go to Europe has decreased 95%, but the EU did not do its part.
Following the Taliban's takeover of Afghanistan, Turkey tightened its security measures at the borders to prevent the wave of Afghan refugee influx to the country. Previously, the Turkish president said, his country has no duty, obligation, or even responsibility to be Europe's refugee warehouse, assuring that international cooperation is needed to prevent a new migration wave from Afghanistan.
There is an urgent need for a new deal for sure. However, this time the deal will be different than the previous one due to the changes that took place worldwide. Not only is it up to EU and Turkey, but also the United States is involved in the issue of Afghan refugees. Turkey now has closed its borders in front of refugees, not only because a deal is not reached yet, but the burden of refugees is actually affecting the AKP internally as well. People have started to feel the burden of migrants and the country and are now pressuring the government to stop receiving them.
The AKP is under pressure from opposition groups and citizens who are calling for a solution for the increasing number of refugees and foreigners residing in the country, which most likely will affect votes in the upcoming elections. Turkish citizens are complaining from unemployment, high demand on real estate, and other problems caused by the fact that Turkey has become a safe haven to those fleeing crisis-hit countries. The Turkish government now has to make a balance between fulfilling the needs of the EU and international community and surrendering to its own people's demand of sending the already existing refugees back. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Around 1,000 people, including dozens of American citizens and Afghans holding visas to the United States or other countries, remain stuck in Afghanistan for the fifth day on Sunday, 5th of September, as they awaited clearance for a departure from the Taliban. The holdup reflects the challenges of foreign governments working with the group, which has yet to form a government. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Melissa Eddy and Thomas Gibbons Neff. The piece is titled, U.S. Citizens and Afghans Wait for Evacuation Flights from Countries North. Around 1,000 people, including dozens of American citizens and Afghans holding visas to the United States or other countries, remained stuck in Afghanistan for the fifth consecutive day on Sunday, 5th of September, as they awaited clearance for a departure from the Taliban. The holdup reflects the challenges of foreign governments working with the Taliban, which is yet to form a government. Negotiations to allow the planes to depart, involving officials of the Taliban, the United States, and Qatar, have dragged on for days, leaving the evacuees in an increasingly precarious limbo, according to representatives of organizations trying to get them to safety. The plight of the passengers, hoping to leave the country from the airport in the northern city of Mazar-e Sharif, mirrors that of thousands of people who were unable to board planes from Kabul Airport, the capital, after Taliban militants took the city on the eve of U.S. troop withdrawal. The American pullout and the end of the two-decade war in Afghanistan were overshadowed by chaotic efforts to airlift tens of thousands of Americans and their allies fleeing the Taliban, who many fear will limit the rights of women and others once they officially return to power. The Biden administration has faced criticism for leaving Americans and Afghan allies behind in Afghanistan after the final troops left the country on 30th of August. Confusion surrounding the departure of the chartered planes from Mazar-e Sharif reflects the chaos in Afghanistan resulting from the departure of the United States and its Western allies, and fears that the Taliban will fail to come good on their promises to respect human rights and not persecute Afghans who cooperated with the American-backed government. The reason the Taliban wants to prevent these people from leaving is likely because they intend to punish them for their cooperation with the United States, said Mick Mulroy, a former senior Pentagon official who has been working with the group Task Force Dunkirk to help evacuate Afghans from the country. If the Taliban really are using people as a bargaining chip, Mr. Mulroy said, that is unacceptable. Representative Michael McCaul, a Republican from Texas and a ranking member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, suggested during an interview on Fox News Sunday that the Taliban were preventing six airplanes from leaving Afghanistan, effectively holding American citizens hostage. State has cleared these flights, and the Taliban will not let them leave the airport, Michael McCaul said, adding that he believed the problem was turning into a hostage situation. Representative Michael McCaul, a Republican from Texas, said the Taliban wanted something in exchange for approving takeoff of the airplanes. He said he believed they were seeking full recognition from the United States of America. But the State Department and organizers on the ground in Qatar countered Michael McCaul's description of the situation, saying the planes had received necessary clearance and were awaiting final approval from the Taliban. The Taliban are not holding the planes hostage, said Eric Montalvo, a former major with the U.S. Marines who is directly involved in organizing the flights. According to documents reviewed by the New York Times, the U.S. military approved three flights to take about 1,000 evacuees, including dozens of American citizens, to Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar. Qatar, meanwhile, has also provided diplomatic clearance for the flights to land, but the Taliban must first allow the planes to depart Mazar-e Sharif airport. If and when the Taliban agrees to take off, we're tracking that the landing sites will be prepared to accept the expected flights, the State Department said in an email to congressional officials that was described to the New York Times. It added that the United States no longer controlled the airspace over Afghanistan. It is a Taliban decision to ground flights in Mazar-e Sharif, the email said. We are, however, providing guidance and assistance to the extent possible and with an emphasis on safety to private entities working out of Mazar-e Sharif. For organizations that have been working around the clock to get U.S. citizens and at-risk Afghan citizens out of the country, the situation has been frustrating and frightening. Marina Legree, the founder and executive director of Ascend, a non-profit organization that provided athletic and climbing training to women, said 34 people from her group, which includes girls aged 16 to 23, had traveled from Kabul to Mazar-e Sharif in hope of boarding an airplane last week. Still, she denied that the evacuees were being held hostage by the Taliban, saying that they were free to leave the airport, as some have. The situation, she said, is growing more dire by the day. The pressure is building, the crowd is growing, it's just a nasty scene, she said. For us, we can't go back. The girls are terrified. My girls are from the Hazara community. Going back is just not an option. They're truly desperate to leave the country. Hazaras, an ethnic minority, were targeted for abuse by the Taliban when the group previously held power before the US-led invasion of Afghanistan in 2001. Marina Legree said she is calling on the US government to use its connections to press the Taliban to let the contingent leave the country. I'm totally worried. I've got teenage girls in there, she said. Surely we have people in the US government who know who to press on. We can't fix Afghanistan, but this is one thing that we can fix. In a statement released on Sunday, the U.S. State Department said the United States government had few resources at its disposal to force an evacuation. We understand the concerns that many people are feeling as they try to facilitate further charter and other passage out of Afghanistan, the U.S. State Department said in a statement. However, we do not have personnel on the ground, we do not have air assets in the country, we do not control the airspace, whether over Afghanistan or elsewhere in the region. Even before the Taliban takeover, Afghanistan placed near the bottom of every list when it came to protections for women, and at the top in terms of the need for any efforts that would make it possible to keep them safe. Since the Taliban swept to power last month, Taliban leaders have sought to convince the world that the harsh rule they imposed during their last stint in power from 1996 to 2001 was a thing of the past. But there have been reports of abuse of women, and on Saturday, 4th of September, members of the Taliban beat women in Kabul who were protesting for their rights. As with all Taliban commitments, we are focused on deeds and not words, the U.S. State Department said in a statement, but we remind the Taliban that the entire international community is focused on whether they live up to their commitments.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello
Hello, welcome to the Spotlight. UK's state-owned broadcaster, the BBC, has admitted that there were serious flaws in the documentary on an alleged 2018 chemical attack in Syria, 3 years after the incident occurred. Why would the BBC come out now and cast doubt on the accuracies of the findings? In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at how flawed info such as this led to the U.S., Britain, and France launching bombing raids in Syria. Did they use flawed intel or fake news to continue the war in Syria?
UK's national broadcaster, the BBC, has admitted that its documentary on an alleged 2018 chemical weapon attack in the Syrian city of Douma contained serious inaccuracies. The program reported that the former inspector with the International Chemical Weapons Watchdog had expressed doubts over the organization's stance on the incident. The watchdog, in its probe into the incident, had blamed it on the Syrian government, a charge Damascus denied. The BBC program claimed the inspector was motivated to go public about his doubts in return for getting financial reward from the whistleblowing website WikiLeaks. Now, the British Broadcasting Corporation has accepted that it had no evidence to back up that claim. Also, WikiLeaks has said such a reward was never paid.
The excuse of chemical weapons was used in Syria again and again. In 2012, 2013, it was used for the sanctions on Syria. It was used for the U.S. beginning military actions. The latest exposé in Douma in 2018 was at a time when every report said Syria was clearly winning the war, and that was why this massive new level of bombardment, happened. They just found a new story. All of the media used it. Hundreds and hundreds of news articles from every direction screamed about it. And now we find it's just a fabrication.
It's surprisingly rare for the BBC to rule against itself. The recent confession is hailed as a major victory for truth.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. We have activist, historian, and investigative journalist, who is a former BBC employee, Tony Gosselin, joining us from Bristol. Also joining us, journalist and political analyst John Bosnich, who joins us from Belgrade.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both, and I'm going to start with you, Tony Gosling, if I may. Tell us what has happened here. You have an incident that happened in 2018, briefly, if you can touch on that for us, and why you think that at this point you have the BBC coming out saying what it's saying in terms of inaccuracies, etc.
So this whole idea of faking weapons of mass destruction attacks is really, this incident in Douma in 2018, this time a chemical weapon attack, supposedly by the President Assad's government, which actually wasn't. I mean, it was all faked. It's very reminiscent, isn't it, of the fake weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which was used as the excuse to go in there in 2003 into that illegal war. And basically, we've got a similar situation here, at least an attempt to do the same in Syria, with all these missile strikes that were launched by the French, the British, and the Americans straight after this fake news attack. weapons of mass destruction back in 2018, also outside international law. So really what we seem to be dealing with here is a bunch of international criminals who want to try to break international law by attacking countries and then persuading their own domestic populations here in the West using the mass media that this is all fine and okay because a certain individual, you know, whether it's Saddam or President Assad, has been using WMD against their own people. Now, you know, the same, of course, was used against Colonel Gaddafi, saying that he was attacking his own people, and that was used as an excuse to attack Libya. So this is really, history repeating itself with the criminals in the West trying to get these wars started. Now, you know, what was the purpose of all of this? Well, it seems to be following the Yinon plan. He was an Israeli general. And he was saying that we need to have all these various attacks on Middle Eastern countries in order to destabilize the Middle East, to balkanize the Middle East. But I think at the end of the day, you know, you could also look upon this as just resource grabs, the attempt of the West with a massive military that it can't really justify to its own population, sitting around. They don't want them twiddling their thumbs, so they want to involve them in invasions. And these media operations are the Trojan horse in the mind of the Western public, which allows them to just get away with criminal acts. And so that's why this is so important. And Peter Hitchens, who's put this complaint into the BBC, myself, I complain to the BBC from time to time. I never hear anything in the national press about it because Peter Hitchens has got a column in the Daily Mail and the Mail on Sunday. They know that they can't just get away with fudging it. It's journalists like me, real investigative journalists like me, who find that because we don't have much of an outlet, obviously I do here on Press TV, but Press TV's banned in the UK, that we find that that those sorts of complaints to the BBC generally get sidelined or ignored, but they realise they cannot ignore Peter Hitchens' complaint on this occasion. And the big problem with this documentary on the radio, first of all, Chloe Hadjamajut, I mean, can't even pronounce her surname. In the world of journalism in Britain, nobody's ever heard of this woman. She's come out of nowhere to produce this fake news report. But right. What she's been doing is an actual, you know, it's well known in journalism as a line that you should never cross. That is, she has put words into the mouth of her source from the OPCW.
Okay.
And that's really the crux of this complaint, is that the Alex, this guy from the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, actually never said what she said he said. So it is fake news, and the worst thing about this particular type of fake news is this is an excuse to start a war. So that's why it's such an important complaint, and well done for Peter Hitchens and the Mail on Sunday for pointing the finger at the BBC as the propagandists they are, and warmongers too, also sure. Trying to include WikiLeaks as part of the scam that they're trying to run. So attacking sure. Real journalists, propagandists attacking the real journalists in Britain.
Right. Well, you mentioned a lot of things there. We're going to get into some of the WikiLeaks stuff and other points that you made there, Tony Gosling. But John Bosnich, I'd like to get this straight because it's confusing, and I'm sure the viewer wants to know this. When you have something like this happen, a documentary being made, and there to be inaccuracies, as the BBC has confessed, it's not as if the person making the documentary just decided on his or her own initiative to include fictional pieces in there. There must have been some directives there. So you got that on the one hand, I'm guessing. And on the other hand, I'm wondering if this is actually happening within the military ranks of the people making decisions, whether they're getting faulty information, whether intended or not. So if you can paint that picture for us.
Sure. First of all, I'd like to congratulate my fellow real journalist for his comments preceding mine, because he's covered all of the key touch points in this story. That's the first point. Secondly, I can share with you my own experience as a war reporter, having covered military conflicts for approximately one decade in various countries. I can tell you that any time that the military-industrial complex of a country can provoke a conflict through the lying mainstream media. And there's a reason why that expression exists. Whenever they can do that, it pays very, very well to do so. It not only sells weapons, it continues the basic system of war as the first response. There's no need for an inquiry. There's no need for an investigation, because the media monopolies in the Western warmonger countries, and I'm sorry to say that because I was born in one and grew up in one of those countries in Canada, but those countries are led by an elite which is responsible to no one. They simultaneously control the military-industrial complex, and they buy up the media through the resources of the military-industrial complex. So what the military-industrial complex does is it provokes incidents. It creates scenarios by which incidents could take place. It hands those scenarios over to its intelligence services like the CIA. As in the case, we can give many instances over the years, but you know, Adolf Hitler used a fake news story about Poland invading Germany in order to start his war on Poland. We know that the Americans used the fake Gulf of Tonkin incident to provoke their entry and their further activity in Vietnam. We know for a fact, I was actually there as a reporter on the scene, that the so-called Racak incident, which was reported as a Serbian massacre in Kosovo, was faked, and we know that it was promoted and called a massacre by the CIA agent operating in Kosovo on behalf of America. So this is not a new tactic. In fact, I would have to say this is the oldest tactic in the book. And the fact that the military-industrial complex is able to so easily infiltrate the media, and that's what they do. They infiltrate the media. There are honest journalists in the media, but they do not control the means of publication. They submit stories, the editors accept or reject the stories, and the stories go forward. When the editors and the publishers get an order from their secret intelligence services telling them that a story needs to be placed, they place it, or they're replaced. That's how the media works in this current system. The media is not responsible to the people. And when the military uses a media fake news, and I want to go further than fake news, because fake news can be intentionally fake, or it can just be fake through incompetence. Mm-hmm. These incidents are always intentional. They are pre-planned conspiracies to use the media to allow a freedom of hand, a freedom to make war, that is not constitutionally available in the countries that make those wars.
Sure.
And that is the main thing that's happening here.
Tony Gosling, you know, this has been rehashed in the past, and that is the role that the OPCW played in this whole alleged chemical attacks, accusing the Syrian government and Russian forces, perhaps, of executing it. And if you can tell us the role that the OPCW played, because there have been obviously allegations made here against them that they have sidestepped concerns about the controversial investigation into that attack, and even accusing the body of accepting unsubstantiated or possibly to have manipulated findings. Do you see the OPCW to be guilty of that?
Well, look, the OPCW is what I would call a point of struggle. It's one of those international organizations which is absolutely critical to stopping this kind of attack. But it's an organization which is very much in the crosshairs of the Western military. They want to control that organization because they know that if they can get them to make statements, I mean, we've seen, for example, the way the International Olympic Committee, as another international body, has been used as a stick with which to beat Russia over doping. All countries pretty much use doping, but Russia was singled out for that purpose because it's part of the Operation Beluga, which is a Western NATO intelligence service operation in order to discredit Putin and discredit Russia in the Western press. So, you know, that's the sort of thing that is going on in the OPCW. But I'd like to also point to the specific organisation, the White Helmets, which was used in this documentary. They, the boss of those, supposedly committed suicide, although it looks very clear, if you look at the evidence, that the money for the White Helmets was coming through British intelligence, through MI6, and that this was really just an intelligence front. So what the British intelligence were doing was they created a so-called humanitarian organisation equipped with video cameras to go out there and actually to work for British intelligence, to deliver stories to the British mainstream news night after night, which would be favourable to the British view that there needed to be regime change in Syria. So this was a propaganda attempt, and this is the information that was picked up partly in this documentary. But more importantly, I just like to explain to your viewers how it works here in Britain, that a so-called independent media, state-run media, like the BBC and others, of course, can report in such a biased way a complete fake news story designed to start a war. And that is because we have a unit in Britain called the 77th Brigade, which is a psychological warfare, what they call information operations brigade. It's a rather large army formation put together for psychological warfare purposes. And whilst their own serving members in that brigade and in those offices putting all sorts of fake news out in the mass media and elsewhere and actually on the internet, the idea is also to get people sharing these memes up on social media, is that there are quite a number of retired army officers who are now working within the mainstream press. So, you know, this has happened over the you know, last 50, 60 years. Quite a lot of, for example, from World War II, officers from the forces then went in the 1950s, 60s and 70s to work in the media in Britain. But they are reservists still for the army, and they're working within the media here in the West. And what happens is they get a phone call from the 77th Brigade, hey, we got a great exclusive for you here, and there it goes straight into a news bulletin, or a documentary gets commissioned based on what is effectively an army intelligence operation, a military operation, in order to get whatever story it is they want out there. And that, of course, can be a casus belli for a new war. And the idea is really to hoodwink the British public, hoodwink the Western public, for long enough, as long as it takes to commit the crime to get the war started. Sure. And the 77th Brigade have no such oversight such as the BBC have. So I think that the next step really needs to be to get the 77th Brigade to explain its role in this fake news that was also a war crime.
Are the officials known? Are they known to give interviews? Can you make a request? I'm just asking if that's possible or not.
Well, you can make a request, but the idea that they're going to fess up, put their hands up and say, yes, it was us. We used our army officers within the media in order to plant this story. I'm afraid you're going to get nowhere with that sort of request.
Here's the math here, John Bosnich. I was surprised at this. Again, since it's somewhat dated. You have 20 unresolved issues in Syria's chemical weapons file. Declarations that have been made. You have the UN and the OPCW. They have officially attributed 8 of those chemical weapons attack to the Syrian regime, as they say. So you got 20, 8 of them is towards the Syrian regime. That leaves, 12 that the terrorists have done. So when you take a look at the math there,
even if we,
and how that's obviously much greater than the 8, if the Syrian government is actually did execute it, it's a huge question mark and a huge doubt on the Syrian government, because to this day we still have these Daesh terrorists say there's going to be a chemical attack. Russia makes that announcement. Give us your feedback on just this particular piece of stat.
Okay, of the 20 that you're referring to, I would guess, everything starts with a guess that you have to check, but I would guess that 0 were committed by the Syrian government. Why? Why do I guess that? Because before you analyze, and I worked, you know, I worked as a journalist and a government advisor in Canada and in Japan. First, you have to analyze the basic news story and ask yourself, who would benefit from this news? Obviously, the main beneficiaries of any news that Syria is doing anything illegal are the Western NATO powers that were trying to topple illegally by force of arms the government of Syria. So, once we see a news story that only can possibly benefit the opponents of the Syrian government, we have to look at that news story with deep suspicion, because a balanced news story will quote the government in detail, and it will quote the accusers in detail. And if you check the BBC and you check CNN, you will find that as a general rule, they give 10 times, that's a real figure, 10 times more information against the, and they use the word regime. They don't refer to the Syrian government. So that's a telltale signal right away. The minute you see a report from Western media that refers to the regime of Syria, or the regime of Donbass, or the regime of some place, you know that you're reading a biased report, especially when it refers to English government sources, in the same sentence in which it refers to Syrian government sources as Syrian regime sources. So a cursory glance at a news report will usually tell you whether it's propaganda or not. Then as you go past these first telltale signs, which are always there, then you look to see if they use a resort to authority. So BBC will republish information from Germany, or they will republish information from the CNN, and CNN will republish information from Germany and BBC, and so on, so that they pretend to say, our fellow independent journalists have reported this. And that's always false. Mm-hmm. As a general rule, that's always false.
Okay.
So we've got something that is not just false by accident, it's false by design. And when something is false by design, it should be investigated immediately. And any military action to follow a press report has to be followed first by a public inquiry.
Sure.
Because this carte blanche is the way wars are started, and this is the way millions of people are killed.
Exactly.
Not
and that,
dozens.
And that brings me to my last question. I mean, Tony Gosselin, something's got to be done. I mean, to carry some placards by some people saying, you know, stop lying or stop this propaganda is not going to be enough, I'm guessing, because we're looking at a world where there are threats being made. There are threats being made against the Islamic Republic by the U.S., and we know how the U.S. and the U.K. work together. The U.S. focus
damages
on China.
Damages lawsuits.
Excuse me?
I'm sorry to interrupt here, but I think that the proper recourse is to at least sue the BBC for the damages incurred as a result of its false report on the ground in Syria in the world court. That means tens of millions of dollars
sure.
of damage, not counting the lives lost.
That sounds like a good idea, even maybe more so if you can tell us, Tony Gosselin, what more can be done. Again, we're looking at a world where there is filled with military thoughts, and it's, you know, a lot of it is coming from the U.S., the focus on China, the threats being made against Iran. Biden just last week used the word options when Naftali Bennett visited him. So what can be done to prevent this, at least for the general public to be aware and to comb their psyche so that they don't fall to the trap of the media like it happened with the BBC doc?
Well, look, it's a very difficult question to answer what can be done, because the deep state has a great deal of clout and control of the media, as well as, of course, much of the parliament here in the UK, for example. I think what is a fascinating little smoking gun in this crooked fake news documentary the BBC put out trying to smear Assad is the way they also try to smear Julian Assange and WikiLeaks in the same report, because, as many people know, Julian Assange is on the record as explaining absolutely right and factually that the only way that wars can start is through lies. And he saw it as his life's mission as an investigative journalist, probably one of the most important publishers on the planet, to scotch those lies. And it's no accident, that he is now in jail here in Britain, actually, even though he hasn't actually committed any offence here in the UK. So I think one of the ways we could do something to stop this is to force, through legal means or whatever, I don't know how you're going to do it, but to get Julian Assange
Sorry,
out,
I got to jump in. I do apologize, Tony Gosling. We're just fresh out of time. But thank you. Some great comments there made by Tony Gosling, activist, historian, investigative journalist, and a former BBC employee. And thank you so much, John Bosnich, journalist and political analyst. Wish we had more time. And that does it for this edition of The Spotlight.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in. From Ikara Tafwe, it's goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
After a hellish month, the US President Joe Biden wants to focus on domestic matters, but Republicans won't let Afghanistan drop from the radar. We're prepared for you an article written by David Smith. The piece is titled "Bruised Biden Tries to Turn the Page After US Debacle in Afghanistan." The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Once again, U.S. President Joe Biden found himself talking about nation-building, the fragility of democracy, and the issue of women's rights. But the president's interventions on Thursday, 2nd of September, were focused on America and not Afghanistan, as domestic events gave him an unexpected assist in his efforts to turn the page on the ignominious retreat from Kabul. Historic flooding in the Northeast gave Joe Biden a cue to remind Americans of his so-called plan to spend $1 trillion on infrastructure. Battles over voting rights and a full accounting of the 6th of January insurrection raged on. All of them gave the White House an opportunity to talk about something other than Afghanistan. August has been dubbed Joe Biden's month from hell after his decision to withdraw U.S. occupation forces saw the Afghan government and the army capitulate to the Taliban far faster than he had predicted. The United States then frantically evacuated more than 120,000 people, but 13 U.S. service members died in a terrorist attack in Kabul airport. The president's reputation as a purported safe pair of hands and a safe harbor for Western allies was shaken to its core. While his Democratic allies now hope that the issue will fade from public consciousness, allowing him to renew focus on the pandemic and a sweeping economic agenda, Republicans are determined that Joe Biden should not be simply allowed to move on. Lanhee Chen, a fellow at the Hoover Institution think tank at Stanford University in Palo Alto, California, said he desperately would like to change the subject, talk about domestic matters or COVID or areas where he feels like he has a little bit more control and ability to get engaged. I'm not of the view that it's going to be easy for him to do that. Lanhee Chen said, people will continue to discuss what is happening in Afghanistan. I'm sure Republicans will ensure that his handling of the crisis in Afghanistan remains a campaign issue. Some of this is going to be well beyond his control. If circumstances in Afghanistan, for whatever reason, re-enter the public mind and re-enter public attention, is going to have to respond to that, and there's not going to be a whole lot he can do to avoid that or to change the subject, even if he wants to. President Biden had been riding high in the opinion polls in July when mass vaccinations blunted the coronavirus, and early August when he claimed a bipartisan infrastructure deal as vindication of his faith in bipartisanship. But the chaotic scenes from Afghanistan, including desperate people clinging on to U.S. military plane and a 17-year-old footballer plunging from one airplane to his death, rewrote the narrative. Joe Biden's character and competence were scrutinized, and his approval rating dipped below 50%. But he remained defiant of his many critics, including in the powerful Washington foreign policy establishment. After the final troops flew out of Afghanistan, ending the conflict of 20 years, he attempted to draw a line in the sand on 31st of August, insisting, "I was not going to extend this forever war, and I was not extending a forever exit." Just a day later, as calendars flicked to 1st of September, the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki began her regular briefing discussing the impact of Hurricane Ida on Louisiana and Mississippi. The first question from reporters concerned the pandemic. The second question was about a new law in Texas that is claimed to undermine women's reproductive rights. The grand pivot away from Afghanistan had begun. Jen Psaki added, "The president knows that he has responsibilities, and the multiple crises he will continue to have to face as president are part of his job description. And if there is a meeting warranted in the Situation Room for his military leaders, his national security team, about Afghanistan or any other issue, of course he's going to be there for that." Jen Psaki claimed, "But he also knows that part of his commitment to the American people is getting the pandemic under control, is addressing the hurricane and making sure the people in Louisiana, Mississippi, and other states on the Gulf Coast know he's doing absolutely everything in his power to make sure that they have electricity." Then remnants of Hurricane Ida unleashed record floods in New York and New Jersey, delivering images guaranteed to knock Afghanistan off cable news. Local Democrat leaders warned that such events will become more frequent and ferocious and urged Congress to pass Joe Biden's infrastructure bill. It was a subject that the president was more than happy to talk about. He said, "The past few days of Hurricane Ida and the wildfires in western United States and the unprecedented flash floods in New York and in New Jersey is yet another reminder that these extreme storms and the climate crisis are here. We need to do much better prepared. We need to act. When Congress returns this month, I'm going to press for their action on my Build Back Better plan." Joe Biden claimed, "The infrastructure bill would modernize roads, bridges, water systems, sewers and draining systems, electric grids and transmission lines, making them more resilient to superstorms and to wildfires, as well as making huge investments to combat the climate crisis. Signing it into law would give U.S. President a major political victory to get his presidency back on track. But this scenario is far from certain. The House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate are haggling over both of this bill and a $3.5 trillion budget reconciliation package that invests in child care and other social priorities. Democratic leaders want to pass them together, but party moderates are reluctant." On Thursday, 2nd of September, Senator Joe Manchin, a Democrat, said, "Democrats should hit the pause button on the $3.5 trillion package." Bill Whalen, a research fellow at the Hoover Institution, said, "I'll be very curious what the pivot's going to be for Joe Biden. He needs a win on something. He needs something a little more dramatic than an infrastructure bill. He needs an act of God. He needs a Supreme Court justice to drop dead." In the meantime, Republicans have no intention of allowing Afghanistan to drop off the radar. The former Republican President George W. Bush started the war in Afghanistan. Former Republican President Donald Trump signed a deal with the Taliban to end it. Has not prevented them portraying Joe Biden as a man out of his depth who left behind more than 100 U.S. citizens, thousands of allies, and abundant military hardware in Afghanistan. John Bolton, a former national security advisor under Donald Trump and an opponent of withdrawal, believes the episode will be damaging to the president and could undermine his agenda. John Bolton said, "If you look at his withdrawal as a debacle, it's very widely viewed as, then Joe Biden's mistake, and that's going to hurt him." Bolton added, "Democrats in Congress are very worried that the perception of incompetence will spill over into domestic affairs, and the fate of the $3.5 trillion package and any number of other things could be jeopardized. The swing district Democrats in the House and some in the U.S. Senate are saying this. This is one more piece of evidence that we're going to be in real trouble next year if we just blindly follow the White House leadership on this." John Bolton added, "So there's real trouble ahead for them. It's hard to measure exactly, but I do think in American politics, when you lose the perception of competence, it's very hard to get it back." A blitz of attack advertisements suggested that the Republicans believe they have finally found Joe Biden's Achilles heel. Michael Steele, who was a spokesperson for former House Speaker John Boehner, said, "I'm sure the White House hopes that legislative successes this fall will allow them to right the ship. But nothing will erase the searing images from Kabul over the past weeks, or the damage done to America's credibility." Some Democrats have also expressed frustration at the botched withdrawal from Afghanistan, and three Democratic-led Senate committees have pledged to investigate failures, a rare rebuke for the president from his own party. Joe Biden will also have to contend with the resettlement of thousands of Afghan refugees, a potentially incendiary issue. But White House strategists may be betting that taking a hit in the short term is worth the long-term vindication of ending an unpopular war, given that the average citizen is currently more concerned with COVID-19 outbreaks in schools. And to adapt an oft-quoted Afghan saying, Republicans have the watches, but Biden has the time. The midterm elections will not be held until November of 2022.